From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on April 15th, the day that nearly brought about the end of life on Earth as we know it. Okay, that's probably a little hyperbolic, but here are the facts as we know them. An asteroid roughly the size of, I was going to say a soccer field, but let's say a Walmart, came very close to us. It missed, but as The Guardian reported, it was the closest near miss ever recorded. And here's the most troubling part to me, anyway. Scientists didn't know about it until it was roughly a day away from us. Yikes. This thing was hurtling through space at more than 66,000 miles per hour. How close did it come? Well, it passed by at less than half the distance to the moon. And this little incident, this big nothing if you want to think of it that way, it set off a little conversation about how much we should be focusing on stopping one of these things. Data researcher Lyman Stone tweeted, quote, "A meteor strike is the event that will actually, inevitably, throw humanity back to the Dark Ages," end quote. And isn't that comforting? This hour, let's talk about the near miss and what it means about how prepared we are to deal with a real threat from space. My guests are the ones who are going to solve this problem. Roger Duby, Assistant Dean for Undergraduate Research at RIT and Director of the Science Exploration Program there. Thanks for being here. Are you ready to tackle this mystery, solve it?
Absolutely.
Okay, Brian Koberlein, Senior Lecturer of Physics at RIT. Brian is actually less likely to solve it. He's more likely to say, if it's going to get us, it's going to get us. You're sort of fatalist about this.
I'll take that position, sure.
All right, so in this case here, those of us who aren't in your fields aren't going to know just how serious this near miss was without a little context here. So one of the first questions is important to understand the size. The one that wiped out the dinosaurs was how big, guys?
I think it was about a mile across.
About a mile across.
It was huge. Right.
This one was about the size of Walmart.
Right.
Big, but not nearly that big.
Correct.
If it had hit, well, let's just say if it had come into our atmosphere, this asteroid the size of a Walmart would have done what?
So the very first thing is that the external external parts of the meteor would have been pulled away and ripped away by the atmosphere. But the core inside would make it through. And it's that core that makes it through that's the most troubling part.
And so most of it would have still been intact?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair to say.
Okay. And what kind of damage are we talking about possibly there, Brian?
That size is on the order of city killing. So if it hit Rochester, Rochester would be gone. I mean, you measure the size, the energy levels of these impacts in either kilotons or megatons, which is also what we measure the energy of atomic bombs with. So you're talking about impacts on that scale.
66,000 miles per hour. When's the last time something of that size from space hit us? Do we know?
Yeah, so there was an event in 1908 in the Soviet Union, I believe, that was on that order. And it wiped out, it flattened trees for basically half a million acres. So again, the size of a city just totally flattened everything. That's the last time one of those things made it through. It happened to be in Siberia. So
like the best possible place.
There was no real well, I'd prefer the ocean myself, but yes, it's not a bad place if you're going to have it hit.
Chelyabinsk, Russia. Oh no, I'm sorry. You're talking about 1908. Chelyabinsk, Russia 5 years ago.
Yes.
Had a shockwave that blew out thousands of windows in that city, causing hundreds of minor injuries there, but you're talking about 1908, the last sort of biggish one.
Yes,
in Siberia.
Right.
You'd prefer the ocean to Siberia?
I just think that that's
as long as it wasn't close
place.
To shore.
Right.
Okay. that truly is a safer. Could that cause a tsunami?
If it was close to shore, yeah.
Large enough and close to shore? Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
All right, so listeners, we're going to talk technology. We're going to talk about what we fund and what we should be focusing on and how realistic these threats are and why scientists didn't know about this until late. I mean, what were all you scientists doing anyway? if you got questions or comments, you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Less than half the distance to the moon is pretty close to us, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, in astronomical terms, it's right on top of us. But
right, so it is not hyperbole to call it a near miss?
No.
Correct.
Okay. Why didn't it hit us then?
So its trajectory was such that it just was going to come right by. It was a near miss.
But we don't have this is where I'm starting to flunk all of your classes. We don't have gravity or anything that would cause it to veer off course and come to us.
Not strong enough. I mean, the trajectory of the meteor would change direction slightly.
Right.
But it's going so fast that when it's close to the Earth, that near approach, it's not there long enough for gravity to really catch it.
So here's an analogy. If you think of an NFL football game, and a quarterback has just thrown a long pass, if that football is just touched by a defensive player right after it leaves his hand, it's going to make a significant difference by the time it gets to the intended receiver. It won't be there. It'll be in a very different place. It'll probably get intercepted. If, however, it gets tipped right before the receiver catches the ball, that's going to continue right into the receiver. So where that gravitational interaction occurs is very critical. The Earth, unfortunately, is the target we're talking about here. That's the analog to the receiver. We're too close to the action. We're not going to be able to deflect it.
So let me get both of your take on what researcher Lyman Stone said on Twitter after the report of this near miss. He wrote the following, quote, "The basic math on celestial bodies tends to suggest that a major collision-induced extinction event is likely on a way earlier timescale than any other big disaster, except for maybe the Yellowstone caldera going kaboom. I worry a lot about the asteroid stuff, and I will admit, I think we underinvest in technology to explode, divert, or otherwise wrangle space rocks. But hey, black swans don't happen, right? In the 2170 to 2190 time period, there are two big asteroids slated to make close passes to Earth, possibly even impact Earth, either one of which would cause city-destroying tsunamis if it hits the ocean. Both have atmospheric firestorm potential, too. That's a fun thought. The only comforting thing is that the Earth has been around long enough that most of the biggies that would have hit us probably have already done so."
Mm-hmm.
End quote. There's a lot there, but I want to take it kind of point by point, and then, Keith, we'll get to your phone call in just a moment here. First, he says, the basic math on celestial bodies tends to suggest that a major collision-induced extinction event is likely on a way earlier timescale than any other big disaster, except maybe the Yellowstone caldera going kaboom. Agree or disagree?
I lean towards disagree.
Okay. Why, Brian?
Because it's hard to gauge the statistics of this kind of thing when you're talking about a large event. All of the large, really large ones that we know of are not on target for Earth. There are some close approaches, but the likelihood of having a large one is relatively small. We're much more at risk at that kind of Walmart size or a little bit smaller than we are from a really large civilization-destroying event. And there are other risks that come in, you know, the caldera in Yellowstone or solar flares, or, you know, you can come up with a whole bunch of ways that we could kill ourselves off. But we're remarkably robust. And I think the risk of meteor impacts at that large scale, I think, is he's overestimating.
You're saying we know of the biggies that are out there?
We know of the large asteroids that are out there. So it is where we're kind of the least certain is kind of between a kilometer to 500 and smaller. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of 500 feet and smaller that's the one that we really don't know about. That we estimate we only know about a third of the ones that cross Earth's orbit.
Okay, Roger?
So I think the full picture here that we need to keep in mind is the fact that a lot of this hinges on the detectability. These are basically dark rocks that are flying through space at a high speed against a dark background. Because they're dark, they're not particularly reflective of the sunlight, so they don't light up very well. When they're small, the amount of reflected light just keeps dropping. The smaller the asteroid is, the less light is available for you to detect it. So the detectability drops off pretty quickly once you get to a small size, and that's where we're limited. And that's how we got surprised by the one that we only found out about a day before. The thing was small, and it simply didn't reflect enough light for us to see the darn thing. And it's moving so fast, you need to be looking in the right part of the night sky at the right time to be able to see the thing. And it just happened that this one got by.
I mean, this was a case where everybody's been getting out of their car on a crowded street. You open the door and you think it's clear, and all of a sudden you get buzzed by a car flying that you didn't see before. That was what happened with this Walmart-sized asteroid that missed us a couple of weeks ago. We didn't see it until the last second, and thank goodness it didn't hit us. Are we ever going to have technology that will allow us to see more of these smaller guys?
So that, I think, is the other part of the equation. I think it's very important that we continue trying to develop technologies for that purpose. We're doing really well on a bit of a segue here. We're doing really well in developing weak signal detection techniques for detecting life on planets around other stars. Similar types of techniques, perhaps with some different subtleties, can be developed and applied to trying to find these things with more and more advanced notice. And I think there's a big opportunity there to try to push that envelope to smaller and smaller sizes and therefore be less surprised.
Okay. Let me get Keith's phone call on this subject. Go ahead, Keith.
I got one earth-shattering question that will probably go to rewriting the history books on asteroids and such, all the scientific research. Why is it called a near miss when actually it's a near hit? That's the first question. And the second question is, could there something ever hit into the moon or glance off the moon that we didn't see coming that would send a big chunk towards the Earth?
Okay. So, Keith, thank you. Let's do this. First of all, I think the first question is a little semantic. A near hit. The noun is miss, and it's being modified by near. So it missed us, but what kind of miss was it? Well, it was a near miss. It was a miss near to us. That's probably why it's called a near miss. If you want to modify the word hit, you're starting with the fact that it hit something, and so it wasn't. You would have to change it to an almost hit, Keith, but now we're being semantic, and this is the English professor in me coming out. But I think near miss is the correct term because you're modifying a miss. You're not modifying a hit. So there's that. Now let's talk about what if something hit the moon? Could it redirect something our way or cause damage that way? Anything to worry about there?
I don't think there's anything to worry about, but we know that's happened.
Right.
So we found meteorites that have come from lunar material.
Yeah, we have the same sort of material from Mars. So an asteroid has hit Mars, ejected a large amount of material into the interplanetary region. It orbits around the sun for a long time, eventually comes down as a meteor during a meteor shower, and we end up with these little rocks on the Sahara Desert that stand out like, my goodness, that doesn't belong here because it's dark. And so, yes, ejection like that does happen, but a lot of kinetic energy of the original asteroid gets absorbed in the impact. The amount that gets transferred to the ejecta is much, much lower. So it would take a huge thing hitting, for example, the moon to be able to launch an appreciable amount of material that we would have to worry about it. So I'm not as concerned about indirect hits like that.
Okay. And you're saying we have Martian rocks because of that?
I have one in my office. I can bring it in at any time. That's, yes.
You want to say, what did you say, Brian?
I said he's so lucky. He has a Tesla and he has a Mars rock.
Life is good.
I guess life is good that way. Okay. But that makes me wonder, because I'd never thought about other bodies in our solar system getting hit.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to be tracking anything that could hit the moon?
Again, I think the kinetics of an indirect hit are things that we should not be worrying about.
Okay.
I think
that's not a concern.
The nearly hit us, as Keith was suggesting, is the thing that we should be focused on. Let's watch out for those things. In a sense, we're sort of like standing out in a field, knowing that somebody has shot an arrow toward us, but because the cross section of the arrow tip is so small, we can't see the darn thing until it hits us. And that's the issue that we're facing here, except that we've got the illumination problem also.
I don't like using the word certain in this context, but I'm going to use in a way that I think you'll understand it. Are we certain that we know, or close to certain that we know, all of the big ones that could cause extinction at this point?
Yeah, We're very close to certain.
Out to a certain amount of time in the future, yes.
Mm-hmm.
There are other mechanisms that are occurring that can bring in larger asteroids over time. And so in a century or two, we might find new ones that we hadn't been aware of. And it's not because we were dumb or couldn't detect them as much as new material is sweeping by us all the time. So sure, we might find other things later. That's not out of the question. But I think the ones that are going to hit us in the next 200 years, we're probably very aware of.
Adam wants to know the difference between asteroid and meteor, because we've been talking about meteor, meteorite, asteroid. Can you help us with some definitions, guys?
Yeah, very basically, an asteroid is a rock in space, a meteor is a rock in the atmosphere, and a meteorite is a rock that hit the Earth.
All the same thing, essentially, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Same kind of stuff.
Different stages.
Different locations. Yeah. So it's magma and lava.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Thank you for the question there, Adam. That was helpful to know. I want to get back to what researcher Lyman Stone was writing. By the way, what's going on with the Yellowstone caldera? Is that something we should actually worry about?
Well, so it's been erupting more frequently than it has in the past. And people are concerned that that is an indicator, a precursor of a very large eruption. Yeah. Most of the geologists seem to be reassuring the public that, no, actually, it's not a precursor. If anything, it's blowing off some of the pressure, and it's actually a good sign.
The Yellowstone caldera is a volcanic region that's basically the size of Yellowstone Park. So imagine a volcano that big if it goes off. And we know, I think it was 600,000 years ago it went off, was the last time or something. And so there's, you know, these kind of apocalypse scenarios of we'd throw ash all the way to Rochester from there, and we'd be covered in 3 feet of ash or something like that if it erupted. But yeah, there isn't a strong indication that that eruption is imminent in any way.
Okay, because sometimes I'm a little fuzzy on the good, bad thing, but that's bad.
It would be if it happened.
Yes. It was an extinction event the last time, and it would be again. Whether or not we'd be in that extinction zone in terms of our species, I don't know.
Okay.
But it certainly had a dramatic effect at that time.
All right. Important safety tip. Thanks, guys. That's the Yellowstone caldera. But Lyman Stone goes on to write the following again, and let's take it again point by point. He says, I worry a lot about the asteroid stuff, and I will admit that I think we underinvest in technology to explode, divert, or otherwise wrangle space rocks. And then he says, but hey, black swans don't happen, right? So black swan, as I understand it, refers to an unexpected event that I think we can just leave it at that, just sort of an unexpected major event. That's why I asked about the certainty of how much we think we really do know about a possible extinction level or close asteroid. So obviously the Lyman Stone's a little more apocalyptic in his concern than you guys are, and you're making me feel better about it. But he does say he thinks we underinvest in technology to explode, divert, or otherwise wrangle space rocks. Are we underinvesting in that technology?
So I would say that the technology needed to address this problem has two aspects. The detection, which is critical, and then the action that we might take to divert. And those are two different things. He's only citing one of them. I think that it is as important, if not more so, to detect. Because we need to detect these, as I had mentioned earlier, very difficult to see dark objects flying at high speed toward the Earth. We need to detect them at several points so that we can interpolate an orbit and determine where they're going. And that is a difficult job. So I think there's a whole aspect to this that also has to get a fair amount of focus.
Okay. Brian?
I would agree with that. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that when we talk about detecting these kinds of asteroids, for example, or even, you know, deflecting these types of asteroids, the technology that it takes to both detect and deflect overlaps with other technology that is also useful. So to give an example, there's the Gaia satellite has just done a massive release of data, and its mission primarily is to map about 1 billion stars in the Milky Way, where they are, how they're moving, what type of star they are. And it does this by scanning the entire sky from space. In the release of data, we have, I want to say, something on the order of 200,000 newly discovered meteors, or asteroids. Because if you can measure the positions of stars and those types of bright points of light, you can also detect asteroids. So a mission that's looking at stars is now detecting asteroids. So there is a lot of overlap. And the same thing with deflection and destruction of an asteroid. We have to be able to get there. We have to have the rocket technology to go there. As we develop that, that's going to allow us to go to Mars. It's going to allow us to mine asteroids. It's going to allow us to deflect them. The same technology that we want to do for other purposes overlaps with the necessary technology to do this.
Okay. But in terms of the actual investment, would you increase it? I don't know what we're spending these days.
I think for me, what I would say is increasing the specifically hard-to-find ones that can cross Earth's orbit. Because we can find a lot of them, depending on where they are in the sky, affects how easy they are to see. So ones that are, say, outside of Earth's orbit are much easier to see because in that direction, it's away from the sun. It's against a cold background of space. And with infrared detectors, they're much easier to see. If they're inside Earth's orbit, particularly if they're closer to the sun, that's really hard to see because most of these asteroids we detect with infrared detectors. And the problem is that when you get too close to the sun, they don't work well. So it's hard to see asteroids that are coming in from the direction of the sun, kind of in an unexpected angle at high speed. Those are the ones that are the hardest to detect.
Hollywood has us thinking that it's going to be nuclear warheads planted on one of these suckers to knock them off path. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. No?
Well, probably. There are a whole raft of issues associated with that. To begin with, if you think of anti-missile shields that countries have been developing and that occasionally political leaders brag about, those things are less than perfect. And so a very fast-moving missile from an adversarial country heading toward the United States, for example, we've got a very small chance of getting that and knocking it out of the sky. If we launch something and we don't have the trajectory exactly right, we're going to miss it. Same thing is true with the asteroid. We have to really know that trajectory well, or we're going to miss it. And once you miss it, you've lost your opportunity completely. If you want to mount a nuclear warhead based on the chance that you've got, the possibility of missing the darn thing, you can do that. It's very expensive. There's that huge upfront risk of what happens if something goes wrong during the launch. And you've got this nuclear warhead that is now about to fall back to Earth. All of those issues arise, and I think they have to be addressed together as a big package.
All right, so Roger, in the year 2150, mm-hmm. when Connections is still being heard, and it's an international program, and we are preparing to try to stop one of these things, we're going to go back and play the tape, and your prediction is, what is the actual technology we're going to use to try to divert one of these things?
Mm-hmm. My prediction would be, at that point, we'd probably be still looking at changing the momentum of the asteroid, trying to knock it off course. Going back to my original...
With
a rocket that we can land on the darn thing and push, or we can just have a big, massive block of stuff and just slam into the darn thing. Both of those will work. Again, going back to the NFL analogy, if we catch it early enough and our interaction is good because we haven't missed the darn thing, it doesn't take a big deflection to make it miss the Earth.
Sure.
So that's where we've got all
detection
the advantage.
Is the key.
Detection.
Yeah. And it's not going to be, you don't
detection.
Think it's going to be nuclear warheads? Probably not.
No.
I don't think that's likely.
Okay. Brian?
Think more of a tugboat. Mm-hmm. You have a huge steamship coming your way. All you need is a little tugboat to just turn it a little bit to the left. It'll miss you. As long as it's far enough out, it doesn't take a whole lot just to change the directory. So you can imagine landing something on one of these asteroids and just have a little ion engine, and it just thrusts a very light amount of push over a long period of time, and that'll be just enough to deflect it. All we have to do is miss. All we need is a near hit. Not a hit.
Near hit. To go back to Keith. Andrew in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I got a question for our scientists here, actually three of them. First of all, where did this Walmart-size asteroid go after near missing us? Number two, Now, does it have a revolutionary path around the sun, meaning that it could come back again? And number three, just for the fun of it, do I get to name it?
All right, so where did it go? We'll start there.
I don't know. I think it went further out. I think it was from closer off. So it's farther away from the sun now than the Earth. It is in an orbit that will continue to cross Earth's orbit, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it'll be of a close approach to Earth.
That'd be a long time coming again, right?
Right. It could cross our orbit when we're on the opposite side of the sun.
Right.
And that's not a danger at all. That happens all the time.
Okay.
Yeah, you need the coincidence event where it's the Earth is in just the right place and so is the asteroid on its orbit where you have this thing to worry about. That's not a very common event, even with those that keep crossing our paths.
Right. It's like crossing a highway.
Okay. Andrew, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I don't think you can name it, though, Andrew.
Comets can be named by their discoverers.
But this one seems like a... Well, you know what? I was going to say this one seems like a small one. But we've been having a little bit of fun this hour with kind of laughing about the size of a Walmart, and it missed us, and is it a near miss or a near hit? This would have been one of the most devastating news stories in history if this thing hit us. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to downplay that. So... I think it's also important to ask both of you, given that we can only detect, I think Brian said, about a third of the asteroids this size?
Well, a third of the asteroids around 500 meters, 500 feet.
500 feet or less. And this one was, how many feet? I don't know. How big is a Walmart?
I want to say it was about 600 feet.
Yeah, okay, so, that size. So roughly that size. So if we're only able to do about a third of these, you know, we're talking about a lot that's out there, I think at least a lot that's out there, that we might not know about and that we should at least be concerned enough about that it's not a joke. It could do some serious, serious damage. It's not going to end civilization, but it can be absolutely devastating, and I don't mean to downplay it.
Yeah. So. We know that asteroids have hit us in the past. We know that big ones have hit us in the past. And statistically, we can expect that ones of that size will hit Earth at some point in the future.
If you look at the surface of the Moon or Mars, you'll see they're pockmarked with evidence of previous hits by asteroids that have hit them. One of our saving graces is our very thick atmosphere. A lot of the things that will create that type of event on another planet that doesn't have much of an atmosphere don't get to do that here on Earth because our atmosphere tends to burn it up or deflect it.
Right.
Remember, even for our space missions, the angle of approach so that you can actually penetrate the Earth's atmosphere is a very, very narrow window. And so that applies to asteroids as well. They can just bounce off the top of the Earth's atmosphere like a stone being skipped on water if it's not coming in at just the right angle. So there are a whole set of issues associated with this on what's going to make something hit us. Right. It's not a simple thing getting those numbers just right.
It takes extremely bad luck for any individual stone to make contact
sure
with us.
Yes.
I mean, there's a couple of examples. Chelyabinsk in Russia in 2013, and another one that was a bit larger in, I want to say, 1978, 79, somewhere around there. And they're both good examples of how important our atmosphere is, because the one in the 70s came in so shallow that it bounced off the surface of our atmosphere and never actually hit Earth at all. It was bright enough to see in the day. There's video of this thing that's glowing, you know, like a brilliant star in a bright sunny day. So it was very large, but it skipped off the atmosphere because it came in shallow. Chelyabinsk came in shallow too. It was very fast, very energetic, and it was 70 feet across or something. If it had come in very steep into the atmosphere, it would have hit and it would have caused a large crater. But it came in shallow, so it mostly broke apart. Some of the fragments hit Earth, and it created a shock wave, but it was still fairly high in the atmosphere. So the damage was very limited, and that's specifically because of our atmosphere.
But again, Chelyabinsk 5 years ago, you had hundreds of injuries from this thing, the shockwave, blowing out windows in a city.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yes. But you didn't have the elimination of a city from an impact.
Okay. And I think of it, when you talk about a shallow approach, I think of it like if there's a bubble in the air, if a child's blowing bubbles, and you're trying to pop the bubbles, and you kind of just brush off the side of one, but you don't make direct contact, all it does is it knocks the bubble in a different direction. Mm-hmm. You've got to poke it directly to get through. And I think maybe our atmosphere, it sounds like it's the same thing. You've got to push directly to get through it to our surface.
There's kind of a competing of action between our atmosphere trying to break apart and burn apart this meteor at the same time that the meteor has a certain amount of energy trying to get to the surface. So if you go steep, you only have the height of the atmosphere to get through. If you go shallow, it's coming in at such an angle, you have to go through much more atmosphere to do this. And that's a lot harder for a meteor to get to Earth at a shallow angle.
All right, before we get our only break, let me read from the Smithsonian Magazine for an article called about the only person ever hit by a meteorite. And it was the Hodges meteorite. Brought problems to a woman it struck, but good fortune to at least one neighbor. Reading from the Smithsonian, only one person in recorded history has ever been directly hit by a meteorite. Anne Hodges was 34 years old, napping under quilts on her couch in Sylacauga, Alabama, on November 30th, 1954, when a 9-pound meteorite came through the ceiling, bounced off her radio before hitting her in the thigh. It left a deep bruise and catapulted her into both quiet fame and a major legal dispute with her landlady, who thought she rightfully owned that rock. Anne's bruise, documented by a photo in Time magazine, looked painful, but the real trouble started for Anne after the meteor strike. Between the protracted court battle with her landlady and the media attention, Hodges' mental and physical health went downhill, and she separated from her husband and eventually died of kidney failure in a nursing home at the age of only 52 years old. That's the only woman, I mean, only person ever documented to have been hit by a meteorite, but the landlady gets to keep the rock. That seemed like a real injustice to me. If you get hit by an actual space stone, you ought to keep it, even if you're in a place that you don't own the building. Others, by the way, 1992, a meteorite blazed across the sky in Peekskill, New York, before striking a woman's parked car. The repair bill probably stung a bit, Smithsonian says, but she was not injured in that strike. 2003, a 40-pound meteorite crashed through the roof of another home, this time in New Orleans, though fortunately no one was hurt. 2007, a meteorite strike made people sick in Peru when it released arsenic fumes from an underground water source. That's according to National Geographic. And in 2013, of course, a meteorite exploded over central Russia, and the resulting shockwave that was Chelyabinsk injured 1,200 people and caused $33 million in damage. $33 million in damage, 1,200 injuries for a what seems like a small 70-foot meteorite. The one that missed us a couple of weeks ago was 600 feet, for a little bit of perspective there. Our guests this hour are working us through the science of preparing for these things, what we should know about them. Brian Koberline is a senior lecturer of physics at RIT. Roger Duby is the assistant dean for undergraduate research and the director of the Science Exploration Program. You want to call the program with comments or questions? It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let's get our only break and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, we continue our series of interviews with the candidates to fill the seat in Congress of the late Louise Slaughter. On Friday, it's Rachel Barnhart, longtime local journalist. Then in our second hour, why do so many musicians hate Spotify? New numbers about how much artists get paid or don't get paid from streaming services. Is it time for all of us to ditch them? We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we continue our conversation here on the eventual extinction of mankind, or not, we've got Megan Mack in the studio with us, producer Megan Mack, because we are in the fourth day, the second last day of our spring membership campaign.
That's right, Evan, and I'm laughing because during the hour we decided that Connections will still be on the air in 2050. So
that's nice.
Yeah, we'll still be here even if the rest of the world ends.
So. No. We're here right up until that point.
I think we can go beyond it. If listeners want to call, 454-6300. No, we want to continue these conversations with you listeners and our guests in studio, and you make that possible. The funding here at WXXI comes from you. When we say this is member-supported public radio, that's because we are truly here because of you. We're having community conversations, in-depth conversations like this one this hour about the science and the research behind asteroids. You can't get that anywhere else, especially in local media. This isn't the commercial station where you hear maybe a 15-second soundbite from an expert. In this discussion, we're hearing from two experts for an entire hour. And there's value in that. We think that there is, and you can help. Join us in that effort by voting with your wallet, voting with your dollars by calling 454-6300. We're down to our last few days of this drive, and we need your help.
454-6300. And I know you're regular Connections listeners, and so we want you to become members for the first time. 454-6300. Thank you, Megan. We're going to turn back to Brian and Roger, and we've got some questions from listeners. And again, you want to call the program, you can do it, or you can email us, connections@wxxi.org. You can call us at 844-295-TALK. We also learned recently, do not call 800-295-TALK. That's a very different show. Megan Mack, do you want to elaborate on that?
I do. I want to share this story because this made my day. We had a listener call my desk line after the show and say, hey, just so you're aware, if you call 800-295-TALK, you get a very different type of show. And I called the number because I was curious. And it's not a number that you should ever call unless, well, Evan, how would you characterize
it? I would say don't be curious. Just let us convince you not to call 800-295-TALK.
Yeah, stick to 844. 844. Especially if you have children with you.
That listener, by the way, he was just trying to be helpful, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
He was very sweet.
He thought that we said 800 on the air, and he said, just so you know, make sure you say 844 because yes. I called the wrong number.
Yes, okay. Well, I see the phone ringing now. Someone just called 844-295-TALK. That's the number, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Interesting question from Dave. He says, wouldn't it be a better use of available technology and resources to gracefully submit to the inevitability of a humanity-erasing collision with an asteroid and instead prepare a long-term stored record of human history and knowledge and beliefs? The cost of even 10 such library satellites in long-term stable Earth orbits, i.e. millions of years, would be a fraction of non-realizable asteroid deflection attempts and would eventually greatly benefit whoever or whatever replaces us on Earth. We're all going to die at some point, but in this way, our civilization would at least have a good chance of becoming eternal. That's from Dave. What do you guys think?
We already have one.
Yeah. What?
The Voyager probe.
Oh, the one that
has the golden disk.
Carl Sagan in the 1970s?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so we already have a small Earth museum in case of our demise.
Now, and we are currently developing a variety of different warehouses of things such as seeds. They're stored in the Arctic under the ice in the event that something happens like this, so that in principle these can be retrieved and we can repopulate our food sources. The same is true for species that are facing extinction. There are places where they're being taken and protected to try to continue the species beyond what the environment would allow it to do. And so the extension of either of these approaches to something that's orbiting is not a big thing, and I think that's actually an interesting thought.
Yeah. What do you make of that, Brian?
I think, you know, it's definitely worth considering. You know, we are used to our own mortality on an individual level. We don't think a whole lot about our mortality as a species level. But the history of life on Earth is pretty clear on that. We are either going to end as a human species or we're going to evolve into something else. And leaving that imprint is something that I think is deeply ingrained within us as a species. So I can easily see making some type of satellite or storage place that would continue to have an archive of our history and our existence.
I do think what Dave is saying, and this is where, again, I'm going to see if I flunk the test or how I do with our two professors in studio. I think what Dave is saying is the creation of essentially vaults that we can throw into space that will orbit the Earth for millions of years and be stable and could be retrievable by whatever replaces us here on the surface in the future, mm-hmm. versus what the Sagan team did 40 years ago last year, which is to send something into as deep a space as you can, just so anybody else who's out there gets to know their neighbors, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. But, I mean, we have lots of things that are in somewhat stable orbits. So we already have evidence of humanity within our solar system.
I think this is more like, you know, if we have to re-evolve through evolutionary means, that maybe we can discover metallurgy much, much faster. Mm-hmm. But
there are ideas for that, to have kind of
actually, that's a terrible point, because anybody who's technologically advanced enough to get up to our satellites knows what metallurgy is.
Yes.
I don't know. Now I'm okay. Well,
really, it's what's most important would be our biology as what our species actually physically is, mm-hmm. but also our art and culture. That mm-hmm. is the one thing that we can't guarantee is going to be elsewhere. People will learn mathematics. Another species will learn mathematics. They'll learn physics. And probably if they can get to us, we don't have a whole lot to teach them. But they don't have Shakespeare.
And, yeah, you throw a little Miles Davis in there and
they don't have the mythos that comes from around the world.
Yeah.
So our art and music and culture, that's what you might want to say is worth saving.
We lost a tremendous amount of cultural knowledge with the Library of Alexandria being destroyed. Mm-hmm. We don't want that to happen again. And so the presence of data and knowledge on the internet is one way of distributing this knowledge across the globe. It's not a big deal to make copies and put them into orbit of that type of information, including recordings and videos and books and all of these other things that are evidence of our cultural position today. That's something that we definitely should be doing, because it's not a very big step to go from where we are right now to doing that. So I think that's a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, sure. You think about the Library of Alexandria, you think about all of the great authors during antiquity whose works we know exist but we have never found.
Mm-hmm.
The references to works or only partial works lost to history. So really interesting stuff, Dave, and I do appreciate that email. I do think, I go back to the Sagan, what was it called, Voyager?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How the world has changed in 40 years since
yes.
Voyager.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, they didn't have great things like Instagram.
Well, the record itself was a stylus record.
They didn't
record.
Have YouTube comments to enlighten yeah. them.
Right.
Yeah.
It was a platter that was basically a stylus platter. It was you know, kind of like a 33 RPM record that you can play with a needle. And so it throws back to that technology, and that's what we had at that time.
Yeah, I mean, so 40 years later, it feels like an entirely different civilization. I think Voyager that I read last year just is breaking out outside the bounds mm-hmm. of our solar system.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, interesting stuff, Dave. Thank you. John writes to us and wants to go back to concerns about threats to humanity, and he's worried about Yellowstone. And I'm not laughing, John. This is an interesting question. I'm laughing because I don't know why. Maybe it's just a macabre laugh. I shouldn't be laughing. But John says, is there information to suggest, and would it be strategically important for Yellowstone to become a ground zero site for adversaries? In other words, could our enemies on Earth target Yellowstone and attempt to trigger an eruption or something dangerous?
I don't think that's a big risk for a couple of reasons. One is, if you trigger it, there are certain types of weapons that come back to haunt you. You know, there's a reason why we're very cautious about just engaging nuclear weapons to wipe out a country, because the radiation travels, and there's an impact to that for everyone. The same would be true if you triggered an eruption at Yellowstone. It would affect the entire planet. It wouldn't be a targeted strike. It would be a global strike.
It would come back to haunt them.
It would come back to haunt them. But I think the other thing is that the type of energy that you would need to try and trigger this type of thing, even without knowing how you might actually do it, if you have that type of energy that you can release, there are much softer targets. There are much easier targets to hit. You know, you're probably talking about something on the order of nuclear weapons. You don't have to hit Yellowstone to make an impact.
That's a good point. But John, it's a good question, and I appreciate that. Don wants to know, if a single impact from space could look similar to a nuclear detonation, could it trigger an even larger event? A nuclear war. Is there a good way for nuclear powers to quickly know the difference between an attack and an impact that we never saw coming?
That's an excellent point, and he's absolutely correct. That's one of the things that I worry about, frankly, is that an unexpected strike by an asteroid could be misinterpreted as a nuclear attack by an adversary, and it could, in principle, trigger a war. What's critical here is communication, that these countries need to be able to communicate on a rapid timescale with one another, and in a way where they can actually mutually trust one another to say, no, we didn't launch that thing toward you. You got hit by an asteroid, and we have, you know, the orbit that'll show you what happened. We need to be able to make those calls, and we need to be in a situation of sufficient mutual trust that 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 can be averted, because otherwise I think that that's a very possible event that could easily be misinterpreted.
Okay. Brian, agree with that?
I agree completely. I mean, there's a good analogy of it. When they first launched the gamma ray detectors, it was actually a defense project. And the idea was to be able to detect gamma rays from nuclear detonations to look at nuclear test strikes. When they launched this thing, you started detecting these gamma rays at unexpected times. I mean, you're just kind of constantly detecting them. And there was a worry that there was actually nuclear tests being going off. It took some time for them to be able to triangulate that it was actually coming from space. And we didn't know about this until either the 70s or the 80s. It started way back in the 60s, but it was classified. So gamma ray astronomy was one of those things that could have triggered. If we were really that twitchy, we could have launched nukes, because we see these gamma ray strikes. That's it. The same thing could happen here. The right type of impact would look like a nuclear impact, because it's that level of energy. Until you had the time to detect what the radiation levels were, what the energy spectrum was, that would take time. But if you're talking about something to react on half an hour, you can't tell the difference.
Yeah. If a city gets hit, what are they going to assume, right? I mean, if a city happens to get flattened by an asteroid strike, what are they going to assume? They're going to assume somebody pushed a button somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's that we have to avoid, is make sure that there's communication, there's sufficient trust. The trick here is, the more a Cold War mentality settles in amongst countries, the more likely that type of misunderstanding can occur. And that's very disturbing.
Well, and that's another vote in favor of more effort toward detection technology.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, listeners, if you're just joining us, we're here because a couple of weeks ago there was a near miss, less than half the distance to the moon, from an asteroid about the size of a Walmart, about 600 feet, could have wiped out an entire city. Now, it didn't really get all that close, but it got very, as Brian said, it was right on top of us in terms of astronomical thinking. It was very close. And scientists only knew about it about 24 hours in advance, and scientists think they only know about one-third of the objects of that size that are out there. It wouldn't have wiped out civilization on the globe, but it could have done, obviously, very devastating damage in one particular spot and then caused global misunderstanding about what actually happened. And so let me ask both of you, as we get ready to wrap the hour in our last few minutes here, when we talk about funding and prioritization, there is one school of thought that says, until we have that stuff figured out, we shouldn't be doing anything else with our space budget. We shouldn't be going, what are they doing? They're going to Mars. They're planning another probe to Mars. And that we shouldn't be doing anything until we know with a better close degree of certainty that we're closer to getting our heads around exactly what's out there and what could be coming our way, and we could stop it if we had to. Both of you sort of winced at that that absolutist mentality.
Yes.
Why were you wincing?
I don't believe that we have to do any of these things serially, do them one after the other. I think that the knowledge bounty that we get, this plenty of extra technology and information as a result of a space program, is well worth the investment. Putting a colony on Mars, even if it's temporary, if it's permanent, more power to them. We are going to learn an amazing amount of things about the solar system and travel between planets, colonizing other worlds, and that will only benefit us here, because we'll learn things that we haven't learned here yet. There's no reason to think that precludes development of more sensitive detection techniques, because I don't think those are really big ticket items. They're not on the scale size of putting a colony on Mars. They're a very different budget size. I think they don't have to be done serially. They can be done at the same time.
Okay, Brian Cumberland.
I would agree. Knowledge is not a zero-sum game. It's not something where you gain one thing and don't gain anything else. Every single advancement that we do, every single amount of research that we do to learn more about the world tells us far more than we were originally asking. It answers questions we didn't even know we had. And that happens over and over and over again. The idea of eliminating war or eliminating starvation on Earth is not a resource issue. It's a human issue. We have to solve the problem within ourselves, not build a better technology that's going to save us.
Let me grab, against my better judgment, Mark and Macedon. You got to do it in about 20 seconds or less. Go ahead, Mark.
you talk about the physical ramifications of an asteroid strike. What about the biological? What happens if something fell on the Earth, broke open, and loved our oxygen, nitrogen, atmosphere, and just reproduced itself and killed us all? Mm-hmm. Ever think about that one?
Oh, yeah.
Mark, thank you.
Sure. So most asteroids are comprised primarily of nickel and iron. These are big metallic rocks. There is a class of asteroid called a carbonaceous chondrite that has carbon present in the asteroid or meteor itself. Those we've found on the surface of the Earth, as well as conventional meteorite remnants. And the carbonaceous chondrites to date have not yielded anything that begins to look like it might be alive. Nothing, not a trace, of anything that was alive even at one time. So to date, we don't have anything that suggests that this might be a concern. That's really the information that we have now. We could always be surprised tomorrow, but today we don't know that.
Mark, thank you for the call and the question. There are a lot of really interesting phone calls and things to think about. It's always the case when Brian and Roger are here. Our thanks to Roger Duby, Assistant Dean for Undergraduate Research at RIT and Director of the Science Exploration Program there. Thank you as always, Roger. Good to have you.
My pleasure.
And Brian Koberlein, Senior Lecturer of Physics at RIT. And the resident killjoy when we think about all these grandiose things, Brian is the sensible one who talks us down. So nice to have you back here. Killjoy is the wrong word.
Yes.
Rationalist.
There you go.
Is that better?
Thank you very much.
Actually, it makes us feel better, a little less worried about things. But they're always great at helping us understand and contextualize science. Rob Braden, engineer. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you Friday on member-supported public radio.